What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson. Let's get this started.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. In this week's episode, we're going to be talking about gluconeogenesis, which is specifically the creation of new glucose. And I was interested in this topic, or at least researching it, just because in the bodybuilding world, a lot of people are scared of excess protein, and some of the myths around that revolve around all this extra protein getting turned into sugar. So I wanted to look into it and see if that really does happen. So we're going to dive deep into that this week and kind of break that down. But first, let's do a little check-in. So Tom, how's everything been going?
Not good. So the reason this podcast is coming out a little bit late is 100% my fault. So I just started helping out with the old wrestling team that I used to be a member of at the old high school. And I got sick. And I got sick on Tuesday. Today's Sunday, and I'm still not 100% recovered from it yet. So Wednesday, when we normally record the podcast, I was coughing. I was just... The worst part about it, it doesn't have to do with the fever, not the cough. It's the brain fog. Just being dumber. Like, I don't mind taking a week off of training. Hey, you know, that's probably good for my body, let my body fully recover. But not being able to, like, read complex stuff, just sitting around all day, not being able to write anything, just being productive in any manner, was just absolutely driving me crazy.
Yeah, it sounds super frustrating.
Yeah. So, like, I took a lot of Epsom salt baths. I was like, okay, you know, let me make sure my magnesium levels are really high. And just, like, the warm water felt really good. I don't know, just having a fever has been kind of weird. It's freezing outside, I'm burning up, and then I'm freezing cold because I'm sweating too much. I don't know, it's just been a weird feeling. But, you know, it's about time I'm due. I haven't been sick in, I think, over a year, so, you know, it happens.
It does. No, it happens to the best of us.
So what's been going on with you?
A few things, really. I guess, actually, to talk about you taking a break and how that's a good thing. I've had a few days off from the gym as well because I kind of hurt my rotator cuff, like my right shoulder, about maybe 4 or 5 days ago now. And it's kind of embarrassing how I hurt it. It's
taking a shirt off or something.
Well, that was step one. So people don't know I train at my house. I have a whole little like home gym. So one of the benefits, usually I can train shirtless and in between sets. Usually what I'll do is I'll practice some sort of pose for that workout, either like a front double bicep, a back double bicep, or like my quarter turns, which is like something you see like bodybuilders do on stage. And I think that's important because it's actually way harder than it looks to actually, you know, flex all your muscles and hold your breath and do all that stuff. So I do like to practice it. But last week when I was doing back and buys, I was focusing on a back double bicep. And there's a way to do a back double bicep where you can lean so far back that you can kind of see your upper chest from the back, right? If anyone's ever looked at like a Phil Heath, who was a Mr. Olympia, he poses like that. You can see his chest from the back. So I can do that, but I have to really arch my back and I have to really rotate my shoulders, right? And I guess I must have posed 15, 20 times throughout the workout. And later on that day, I realized, like, man, my shoulder feels funny. What is this? And then my shoulder just went dead. Like, I had, you hear, like, a pitcher having dead arm?
Yeah.
Like, I had a dead arm. And so for me to move my arm, I had to pick it up with my other arm. And I was like, oh, this isn't good, you know? And it's not that painful. And right now, I'm okay. But it just, I couldn't train the next day. And it was just weird. Because, you know, the rotator cuff, it revolved, those, like, little movements, that's like all your rotator cuff. It's not really like your delt. You know what I mean? Like those initial few inches when you move your arm, that's really your rotator cuff. And yeah, definitely hurt that. So I had to take a few days off of training. But like you said, I think that's a blessing in disguise. Like I think I do overtrain for the most part. Like I do train probably too much. So taking the last few days off is a good thing. Because I know you don't grow in the gym. Like I don't care how good it feels, how pumped you get. You're just breaking down your body. You actually put on muscle, you know, an hour after the gym when you're eating, that night when you're sleeping, and the following like 4 days just resting. That's when you're actually building your body. So it was a blessing in disguise, you know?
Yeah, let your muscles fully recover. One thing I was going to do when I do the marathon is that last week, well, especially the last 2 weeks of training, I was going to cut it back.
Dial it back.
Like probably just do some yoga, maybe some like 2 mile runs. And that last week, probably do nothing.
Yeah.
So I was like really going to dial it back. So I think there's a lot to just resting and recovering.
Yeah. But it's hard because you don't feel like you're doing shit when you're recovering. You know what I mean? Like you feel like you're growing in the gym, even though you know you're not.
You got to stay busy, find something else productive to do.
Yeah. No, that's true. So that happened. I did like an impromptu 3-day fast this week. And
how was that?
It was easy.
Okay.
Yeah, it was easy. And it just reminds me, I've been so caught up with this, eating these meals, getting this protein in, trying to stimulate like muscle protein synthesis as much as I can, as effectively as I can, like the past few months, ever since that whole diet down to Thanksgiving. So it was hard for me to even think about fasting again. You know, like it's a whole different mindset. And but I just woke up one day, I was kind of full still from the night prior. Well, one, because I had to eat all my dinner and like half of my wife's dinner. Because I think, did I tell you like how I always buy too much shit? Like,
yeah.
So that scenario happened. I woke up the next day, I had like 2 dinners. So I think I had like 7 or 8 pounds of meat the following day. And I was like, man, I am still full. I was like, you know what? I don't want to eat. You know what I mean? Like I just did it. And I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I haven't fasted in a while. I'm going to fast for 3 days. So I did. It all went smooth. And it just reminded me how good it feels to fast. And why people, like, we know it all the time. Some people we work with turn into little fasting addicts. They'll just fast all the time.
Yeah, there's nothing like that feeling of, like, that deep ketosis feeling that you get.
No, clean energy all the time. You sleep like a baby. Yeah.
And my favorite part is just how much, like, free time you have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially cooking 7 pounds of food. It takes a long time.
Yeah, feel sorry for me, man. I'm always in the damn kitchen. Yeah. So I did that. It was great. And I'm really glad I did it. I finished that book, Power, Sex, and Suicide.
I didn't even think you were going to.
I didn't either, man.
It sounded like every week you were like, I give up all this book. I gave up on it.
I was so done with that dumb
book. Was it worth it?
I don't know if it was worth it.
I would take that as a no.
Yeah. It was definitely a deeper dive into like the mitochondria than I was used to, into apoptosis than I was used to. And I sent you that little picture, actually, how to pronounce apoptosis.
Yeah.
Because I wanted you to see, like, I'm not just making that shit up. It's not pronounced apoptosis, even though you'll hear that a lot. But
that's how I learned it in school. It's like, it's popping a cell to make it, like, explode.
Yeah.
That's how you, apoptosis.
Apoptosis, yeah. And that's a good little, I don't know, I guess a method to remember what that word is, but it's just not, that's not how you pronounce it. But, like, I had to, what was going on with that book, I was reading it, and it was putting me to sleep. And that's rare for me. Normally, I can read, like, legit for hours, and I'm good, because I'm engaged.
Yeah.
This one, I would read for a paragraph, and I would literally fall asleep. So what I did, I just made coffee, and I kept drinking coffee until it was impossible to sleep. So that's what I've been doing to get through that book, because I was just like, I have to finish it. And it was really cool. There were some few facts that I liked, and I posted a quick video about it. Like, it was very interesting, but the details were so minute and kind of above my head, honestly, like above my pay grade, that I'm gonna forget this shit in a week, if not already. You know what I mean? Like, if I had to write a review of it, it'd be real shitty because I just don't remember it.
So it's not like a textbook.
It was, you know, I don't know if I would call it a textbook. I think it was just the way the author wrote.
Okay.
Me and him did not vibe.
Okay.
You know, maybe you'd read it and like you pick it up. I just didn't, for whatever reason. And like, you know, I know, like, we say apoptosis, like, people think it's a fancy word. Or we say gluconeogenesis, people think that's, like, a big word. For us, it's not because we know what it is. I think that author was so fucking smart. Like, every big word that fuck could use, he did. There was no, like, simple language.
Okay.
And I was just like, man, like, every other word, like, I had it on Kindle so I can, like, pull up the definition of shit. It was like, every other word, what does this mean? What does this mean? And that kind of messes with the flow. So I mean, whatever.
So it sounds like that was targeted for, like, doctors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. It was definitely targeted to, like I said, somebody who maybe got their PhD in some sort of, like, biochemistry, and I didn't. But either way, I'm glad I did it. And it made me kind of look back into all the books I read last year. And I'm not the biggest on New Year's resolutions, like, one big resolution, because I think every day, you know, you try and improve, you try and get better, and you always have goals. But this year, I did think about it. I'm going to go back and I'm going to reread every book I read last year. I'm going to reread again. That's going to be my thing.
It's a pretty lofty goal.
Oh, yeah. It's a shit ton of books. And it stems from some guy at work. And maybe I'll even ask you this question. Like, he's interested in this way of living, right? High fat, animal based, evidence based, I would argue. And he's like, so in plaques, like there is cholesterol in plaques. Yeah, there's fat in plaques. I was like, yeah. And so you're saying you can eat a bunch of animal fats and it's not going to build up as plaque. And I was like, no, it won't. He's like, well, how come it won't? And I, in my head, I'm just like, it won't. I was like, yeah, there's inflammation and like cholesterol's response to inflammation is to help build up this plaque. But his question was a fairly straightforward question. And it was just, I wanted to say like, just believe me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, fat's more of a lubricant as long as it's at a temperature where it's not going to turn solid. And in our body, fat's not going to turn solid. It's too, we're warm-blooded creatures, so it's going to be.
Yeah, and I said fat is never in our blood.
Yeah.
Like, there's lipoproteins in our blood, not fat. Fat and lipoproteins are carriers of fat. And, but I think his question was so, he worded it in such a way, he thought it was simple, but it's more, there are levels to that shit. You know what I mean? There's hormones in play, there's more to it. And I was like, the very first book I read that kind of put me down this path, I guess, was a book called The Great Cholesterol Con. And it just broke down the history of why everyone hates cholesterol and why all of that is honestly bullshit. And I was like, you know what I need to do? I need to reread that book. Because if someone asks me that question, I really want to be able to fire back, no hesitation. Because I know deep down in my heart, cholesterol is not a problem.
No, it's a benefit.
It's a benefit. And I should be able to kind of deflect naysayers and help people who are interested, I think, better. I'm not good at articulating those thoughts.
I mean,
you're way better at that than I am.
Well, it's like the best way to put it is it just doesn't. Like,
that's what I left out. People don't believe you.
There's like so much clinical evidence and just like stuff that it just doesn't happen. Kind of like with the whole vitamin C and carnivore. Like, shouldn't you have scurvy?
I should be dead.
Yeah. Like, well, your teeth aren't falling out.
No.
Like, you're not eating moss on the trees when you walk by. Like, you don't have scurvy.
Yeah.
We don't know everything yet.
Yeah, we don't.
So it's like, you know what? I don't know, but it just doesn't.
It just doesn't. And that bugged me that was like my answer. And I was like, okay, so I need to go back. I need to relearn all these things. And like we just mentioned a while ago, reading books multiple times, listening to audible books multiple times is a good way just to help solidify all this information in my head. And it's a blessing and a curse where we both come from. We don't have PhDs in like chemistry or physics, the one particular field, right? So we kind of approach this like a shotgun.
Yeah.
Like, we know a little bit about training, we know a little bit about protein, we know a little bit about all this other shit, right? And so I've read books about everything from soil to mitochondria to soy. And it's a lot of info to kind of digest in my brain. So I think hopefully if I can go back and reread all of this shit, I'll just be smarter. That's it, you know?
I mean, that's a good strategy. There's just too many books that I want to read for me to go back and do that. Because my mindset is, like, there's still stuff I want to learn about something I have no idea in.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier for me to read something that I don't know anything about because I'm, like, so interested in what's going to be on that next page. Mm-hmm. When I read a book that I've already kind of know a lot about and I don't read anything interesting for, like, 10 pages, I'm, like, not as interested and just, like, I have a hard time getting through it.
Yeah, and I might experience that. I might experience, like, all right, hurry up, get to the point. Like, I know Anselke sucks. Like, I know sugar is bad. Like, I might go through that again, especially... I'm actually not looking forward to reading Good Calorie, Bad Calorie again because it's such a daunting book.
Really long.
It's so long. But I'm going to. I'm going to reread that book. And I don't know. We'll see. I'm talking a big game now. By like November, December, I might not be. But right now, I'm going to do that. I'm going to power through these books. I'm going to get smarter. And I feel like right now, my memory with these previous, I don't know how many books it is, say 20 or 30 books, is that like maybe I remember 20% of everything. If after this year I can remember maybe 40%, I'll consider that a victory.
Well, it kind of sucks that you feel like you need to do this because where's the evidence that fat does cause plaque? Like, where's the evidence of that?
Oh, some shitty epidemiological studies. Not even studies, lists.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's not science.
No, it's not science.
I mean, you could correlate owning a TV to heart disease. You can correlate having a car to heart disease.
100%.
Cell phones to heart disease. Like, all these things correlate. It's the same thing as those epidemiological studies.
It is.
So it's kind of, I really wouldn't call that science.
No, because it's not. Yeah, because correlation is not causation. Like, they're not the same thing. correlation can just help you kind of guide you down a path to develop better tests, but it can't draw any conclusions. So yeah, that's all that's been happening with me. Like, that's about it. Haven't been working out because I've been resting, and I'm just getting down to this reading shit, man. I just want to be smarter. That's it, you know?
Well, I try to learn something new every day, except this week has been the one week I haven't learned a damn thing.
I haven't been able to do it, yeah.
It's been killing me.
Well, I mean, I guess in my pursuit of trying to be smarter, that goes into this week podcast, just specifically on gluconeogenesis, and I don't know, it's just... You hear it all the time. People don't talk about, oh, eating too much sugar is going to cause damage. Eating too much fat is going to cause damage. Well, in like the standard American diet narrative. But people really are scared about protein. Like, oh, should I get 100 grams a day? 200 grams a day? But if I get 300 grams a day, I'm going to die. And one of those reasons is because people think a lot of protein is going to get turned into sugar. So that's kind of what drove me down this path. But people don't understand all the things that protein is involved in. Like, the list is crazy.
All right, so let's just do a quick definition of gluconeogenesis. It's just creating new glucose out of amino acids. So that's what gluconeogenesis means. We're going to be using that word a lot, so we thought we should kind of explain what it means at the beginning.
Yeah, and gluconeogenesis, in this podcast, we're going to be talking about it from perspective of amino acids turning into sugar, but it also can be fats and pyruvate and lactate. Those are really the big ones that can also be converted into sugar. Because even though we bash sugar all the time, we do, but sugar is 100% necessary for life. There's a reason our blood sugar never goes down to zero. Like, our bodies maintain that in a very narrow range. I think it's called glucose homeostasis. But glucose is necessary 100%. Our body needs it all the time.
Yeah, my thinking on it is let my body figure out how much glucose I need instead of having a can of Coke to satisfy those needs.
Exactly.
What my body created inside.
Exactly. Yeah, and if you didn't know, in all of our blood supply, in our entire body, there's about 1 teaspoon of sugar. It's about like 4 grams. When I tell people that, they don't believe me. I'm like, and you know, there's like, I don't know how many grams in a Coke, at least 30, if not 50.
I think it's
know?
Like 50. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah, we're over 10x. That's like 12x how much sugar's in our entire blood supply.
Yeah, so here's some of the uses for protein. I know we kind of went over this list a little bit, but we didn't do it a good enough job last week. So it builds up your skeletal muscle, your smooth muscle, connective tissues as well. It makes up your bones. It forms the structure of your hair, skin, and nails. It's also a building block for many of your hormones, like insulin, glucagon, human growth hormone. It's your enzymes. Those are what makes all the chemical processes in your body happen a lot faster. That's what separates us from like a coral reef, is we got a bunch of enzymes helping us move.
Yeah, I love that. I remember we talked about magnesium and enzymes, and you were like, we're able to do this because we can do this shit faster. If not, because coral reefs are alive. Yeah. They just move really fucking slow.
Yeah, you just have to watch those videos sped up like 100 times.
Those time lapses, yeah.
For you to know that coral reefs are actually living.
Exactly.
It's building blocks for neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine. I think we talked about how a tryptophan turns into serotonin last week.
Yeah.
Antibodies for your immune system. And then energy substrates, stuff that can be used for fuel, things like creatine. What are some of the other substrates?
Well, one of the byproducts of protein oxidation is just the TCA cycle intermediates. So the TCA cycle is just a cycle for energy in our body. So when our protein gets oxidized, it'll enter into that process like halfway through pretty much and get burned into just ATP. So protein is able to be turned into energy. It is able to be oxidized and burned as a fuel source.
It's just not very efficient. And there's how many other uses that we just list that it would rather be used for one of those than as energy itself?
Exactly. Yeah. So protein has so many other uses. It is able to be burned. It is able to be oxidized and used for fuel. But it's not going to do that if you have other uses that are being deficient. So protein is going to be distributed evenly in a way that you're not going to be deficient in enzymes and still burning all this protein as energy. Like, it's going to make sure all these other systems are topped off and running efficiently, and then all this extra shit, it can just burn off.
Yeah, so our bodies evolved to produce its own glucose to prevent hypoglycemia or low blood sugar, which can be deadly, which we talked about earlier. You never want to have your blood sugar reach, I don't know, what is it, like below 50, 60? Just seems dangerously low. I mean, it's going to be varying between person to person, and there's also how ketogenic you are, how fat adapted your body is.
Do you know they've done studies on hypoglycemia when people on ketosis? Have you heard about those?
No, I haven't. Those must be newer, or are those...
Oh, no, they're actually really fucking old.
Okay, I was going to say, they're either, like, yesterday or 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly, like, 100 years ago. But they gave people, I assume it was insulin, and they dropped people's blood sugars crazy low. I'm talking, like, 10, 20, like, you should be dead. Anybody normal should be dead. But if they were in deep enough ketosis, they wouldn't even pass out. They wouldn't have symptoms of low blood sugar. And that was just one of the ways back in the day, they were like, oh, ketones can be a fuel before everything. Like, it can make up that gap. So, this science ain't new. Like, that's old, you know?
That must be in, like, a sedentary person, though. Because I'm sure they were getting up and moving around. Like, you would want that glucose.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I know it was done in a hospital. So, yeah. It was just... It was a trip. Another benefit of ketosis. But there definitely are some cells in our body that have to use glucose. So, something like the mitochondria... I mean, excuse me, the red blood cells are so small, they don't have mitochondria, so they can't burn fat for fuel. So they have to use glucose. There's certain parts of our kidney that have to use glucose, and also certain parts of our brain that have to use glucose. That, again, they're so small, they're not able to have mitochondria. They just don't have the size.
And depending on like the type of physical activity that you're doing, you're going to want to be using glucose. If you're sprinting away from a tiger, you're going to be wanting to use glucose as that fuel source instead of a ketone body. That's why our bodies can store glycogen in our muscles.
Yeah, and release it when we need to right away. Exactly.
I mean, we can use ketones too. That's how people are able to run 100 miles in a
fasted. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you ever look into that? That guy doing that?
No, I haven't. Yeah. I believe you, and I've heard similar things. When I was still in Sac State, my professor was he's running the exercise physiology lab, and there was an ultra marathoner there. Some tiny little...
A student?
No, she was a teacher, I believe.
Oh, okay.
She's like 60 years old, and she was one of those ultra marathon runners. And he's taken her in the lab a few times, like fully ketogenic diet. I think she was almost like 100% carnivore, too.
This is cool. Who is this lady?
I can't remember her name. It was something Middle Eastern.
Okay.
But the percent of fat that she was using while she was exercising was like the highest that he's ever seen.
It was like through the roof?
Yeah.
That's cool, man. Yeah.
And it's like, it makes sense if, like, I mean, you have how much of it available? Just like, I don't know, pretty much an unlimited resource on your body.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that your body can do that.
That's really cool. And that goes back to, like, the studies being done around sugar being done by, like, Gatorade. Of course, they're going to say we have to use sugar for X, Y, and Z. You know what I mean? But, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of sugar in Gatorade. I never really realized it, but, I mean, they need to. And the benefits of Gatorade come more from the sodium and the other electrolytes. The sugar is just there, so it tastes good. Make it palatable.
Yeah, so it doesn't taste like my salt shots that I do. Yeah, which are fucking gross. Yeah. But, so yeah, looking into this a little bit, we talked about, you know, we're kind of down on sugar. We don't really think people need to be consuming nearly as much sugar as they do, which is true. But one of the negative effects of sugar is the hormonal response to it. So when you eat sugar, within 30 minutes to an hour after that, your sugar blood sugar goes through the roof and your body has to produce a lot of insulin to get that sugar down. And that's called like an insulin spike. It's not a good thing. Hyperinsulinemia is a problem. That's when someone eats sugar all the time. And people will kind of tie that back into protein. You'll see protein does cause an insulin response. And that's true. Eating protein does cause a rise in insulin. However, consuming protein also stimulates a rise in a hormone called glucagon. And glucagon is kind of like insulin's, I don't know, evil twin.
Antagonist.
Antagonist, yeah. Exactly. So insulin brings sugar down, glucagon brings sugar up. So it's kind of like a yin and yang. But this happens because certain amino acids react with the alpha cells in the pancreas, causing glucagon to be released. And certain other amino acids react with beta cells in the pancreas, causing insulin to be released. So what's really important when we eat these foods is to keep these hormones, the ratio of insulin to glucagon, similar. We don't want them to get out of whack. So when we eat carbohydrates, only insulin is produced and insulin rises, glucagon does not. And that makes sense. Why would you want glucagon to be elevated, which causes sugar to be created, when we just ate a bunch of sugar? It makes no sense. Sugar is like poisonous in our body. Our body wants to get rid of it as quick as possible. But when we eat protein, both insulin and glucagon will be elevated, which keeps that ratio intact, which keeps everything kind of humming along perfectly.
Do you know why that is? Is it just because we need energy to create energy? Is that
why? What is
why we would release the glucagon
when we eat protein?
Yeah. Is it just to break down the protein, basically?
Well, it's to support our blood sugars.
Okay.
Yeah. So pretty much when we eat protein, insulin is elevated to allow amino acids to get into the cell. However, insulin is only elevated slightly. It's not that much. Normally, it doesn't really create any problems. But while insulin is elevated to help shuttle amino acids into the cell, it can't help but move some blood glucose into the cell as well. And this will cause your blood glucose levels to decrease. So it actually, insulin will pull glucose and amino acids into the cell. However, when you eat protein, this isn't a problem because glucagon also gets elevated. And also, did you know glucagon is produced by the stomach?
Oh, I did not know that. That's...
It is. Glucagon is secreted by the stomach as well as the pancreas. And this hormone tells the liver to release glycogen to help maintain blood glucose while the insulin is elevated, dealing with the extra amino acids in the bloodstream from the high protein meal. So it's honestly a perfect harmony. And when we actually look into protein ingestion, it's like, oh, our body is used to this shit. This is what it's supposed to do. Like, it actually works great. When we look at how our body responds to like a candy bar or like a Coca-Cola, it's like, oh, this is all out of whack. This is not how it's supposed to be. And it's like, yeah, no shit. This just happened like 100 years ago. This is new. This whole thing is new for our bodies. So the ingestion of protein is like a perfect harmony of a little bit of insulin, a little bit of glucagon, and we're good to go.
So with that, if you're just eating just protein by itself, you can actually have hypoglycemia, like low blood sugar, because of the insulin response. Not like a massive effect of it, but it's going to be removing some of the glucose from your bloodstream.
Yeah, but the protein is it's going to cause your pancreas to release glucagon, telling your liver to release stored glycogen for glucose.
Okay, so that's preventing hypoglycemia.
Exactly. Yeah, so it prevents hypoglycemia. Yeah, exactly.
Unless you eat too much protein at once for your body to keep up with that?
No, I don't think so, because the protein, and again, this is another talking, just compare it to carbs real quick. Within 30 minutes to an hour after ingestion of carbohydrates, most of those carbohydrates are going to be in your blood supply. That sugar spike is happening then. When we eat protein, it's going to be drawn out. So your body wouldn't absorb protein fast enough to cause your liver glycogen to get so depleted that there's not enough glucose there to support your blood supply.
Okay.
Because there's only 4 grams of glucose in our entire blood supply. There's more than enough glycogen in our livers to support that. So it's a speed thing as well. The speed of protein digestion does matter as well.
So there are people that have tried like a high protein diet that have dealt with bouts of hypoglycemia from the high protein diet. So yeah. What's the cause of that?
I don't know.
Would it be from the insulin response and just they're not creating, or they don't have enough stored glucose?
Maybe. I mean, I'm sure because the people you're talking to, was it Jimmy Moore?
Jimmy Moore's dealt with it, and I've also heard other people that are also like type 2 diabetics having the same similar issues.
Yeah. So everything I'm just mentioning, it really pertains to just normal healthy individuals that have normal cells that respond to hormones in a normal fashion. But when you become insulin resistant, which happens in type 2 diabetes, things kind of go out of whack. And someone like Jimmy Moore, who, how much did he weigh? He was heavy.
He was like over 400 pounds before he like went low carb.
Lost weight. Okay, yeah. So he was like morbidly obese. And that doesn't happen with every type 2 diabetic, but every type 2 diabetic is paying a price somewhere metabolically. So I don't know exactly what happened, what's going on with him that caused that response, but it definitely is a resistance. It could be an insulin resistance. It could even be their cells being almost a glucagon, resistant to insulin as well as being resistant to glucagon. Like maybe there's a yin and yang going on where they're fucked twice, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could definitely see that.
Yeah. Because the thing with type 2 diabetes, well, really type 1 diabetes, it's glucagon run amok. So when glucagon's constantly elevated, your body's constantly breaking down protein, it's constantly breaking down fat, it's constantly breaking down glycogen to support blood glucose. And eventually a type 2 diabetic will damn near turn into that because glucagon will always be elevated because insulin checks glucagon. So when your insulin, when your glucagon producing cells become insulin resistant, your glucagon's always elevated. So But this isn't like a light switch. It's not like when you become type 2 diabetic, all of a sudden this happens. It's like a gradient. So maybe Jimmy Moore was farther down that line than other people, or vice versa. You know what I mean? So just like we talk about with ketosis and with everything else, it's not like, what's the word? It's not like on-off switch. You say it all the time. It's like, it's a, there's like a gradient.
It's like a dimmer switch, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a dimmer switch. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything in our bodies like that. There's some sort of spectrum on everything.
Yeah, there's a spectrum. Yeah, exactly. So, and that kind of just breaks down now as far as gluconeogenesis does happen. Like our body will break down protein into sugar. But like I said, when we do ingest protein, that glucagon will tell our livers to release glycogen, supporting our blood supply, our blood glucose supply. So now the liver is depleted of glycogen because while insulin was elevated to deal with the amino acids, it released all that glycogen. So now later on in the metabolism of that meal, the high protein meal, say 3, 4, 5 hours later, when our body is still digesting that protein, it can use those amino acids to now replace the liver glycogen that was used. And when that happens, our amino acids through the portal vein are taken right to our liver initially. And the bulk of amino acids are going to be dealt with there. And if it needs to be turned into glycogen there, it will. It doesn't take an insulin response because the amino acids are already in the liver. So it's just a more efficient, more metabolically, I guess, safe way to create glucose on site where we need it in the liver and stored as glycogen.
So gluconeogenesis is a demand-driven process. So it's going to happen when our bodies are very low on sugar. We want to keep our blood sugar in homeostasis at a perfect level. It's called glucose homeostasis. So yeah. We're going to make sure it doesn't get too high, which is very dangerous, or too low, which is very dangerous as well. Like if your blood sugar gets too high, it'll cause glycation. If it gets too low, we'll have very low energy and make it almost impossible for us to do anything. So it needs to stay in that happy medium, that Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, it does. And just like I said, gluconeogenesis isn't substrate driven, it's demand driven. So the demand for more glucose is there after a high protein meal because the liver is deficient in glycogen. So now the body's telling, or the liver, I guess, is telling the body, hey, I need glucose here, make glucose. So the hormones are in line to produce glucose. That's when it does happen. It doesn't just happen willy-nilly just because. The hormones need to be there. Hormones dictate everything that's going on in our body. So I don't give a shit if you eat, I don't care how much protein it is, 300 grams in one sitting, which I think I've done before, I'm sure I have. It's not like 300 grams of that protein are going to get turned into 300 grams of sugar. The sugar that needs to be replaced will be replaced, but besides that, it just won't get turned into sugar. And there's a little quote talking about all the research on gluconeogenesis that I wanted to read. And it says, our data so far indicates that under almost any physiological situation, an increase in gluconeogenic precursors, which would in this case would be amino acids, supply alone will not drive glucose production to a higher level, suggesting that factors directly regulating the activity of the rate-limiting enzymes of glucose production normally are the sole determinants of the rate of production. Hence, there will be no increase in glucose production if the increase in gluconeogenic precursor supply occurred in the absence of stimulation of the gluconeogenic system. Pretty much meaning we're not going to make sugar unless our body needs it. The hormones need to be in place.
That's probably because our bodies can only store so much glycogen. And then after that, it's going to have to be in our bloodstream. So why would our body just cause ourselves just to have hyperglycemia? Like that's what the result would be if...
Exactly.
If gluconeogenesis was just running rampant.
And you think our body's that dumb?
Some
people's are.
Yeah, so I was like, some are.
That's true, actually, yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't really say dumb, but they're just deranged so much from just having 25 Coca-Colas a day. And your body's... That glucose homeostasis is at like 150 instead of at 80 like it should be.
Yes, that's actually a great point. And that kind of goes into the next little topic is situations where higher blood glucose from protein consumption would be a problem. And like you'd probably want to limit the amount of protein you're actually consuming. So like you talked about Jimmy, what's Jimmy Moore's podcast?
He has like 5.
Like, what's the one you listen to the most, I guess?
Living La Vida Low Carb is like the one that he's had the longest.
Okay.
He also has one, the last couple episodes I kind of recommend because he talks about his carnivore diet where he actually has a really high increased protein. It's called the Keto Hacking MD. He had Sean Baker on this week talking about how he did on the carnivore diet and everything.
Oh, did you listen to that?
I listened to half of it.
How was it?
Nothing new.
Nothing new. Yeah, same old shit.
Yeah. I've listened to too much Sean Baker, so it's not nothing groundbreaking. Yeah. Maybe it is to somebody that hasn't heard him before. I mean, he's a great guy to talk about. He's like the godfather of the whole carnivore movie.
Poster child, yeah, for sure. Yeah, so Jimmy Moore did it, and on the carnivore diet, he did. I follow him on Instagram, so I see he did modify it a little bit, because he really kept his fat, elevated as shit. So he had like burgers, and then he'd put like a ton of butter on the burgers.
He was more worried about staying in ketosis than anything else.
Yeah.
So he wanted to make it, the only thing that he was changing was like, I'm eliminating vegetables. I'm not messing with any of the ratios. So mm-hmm. I want to make sure I stay in ketosis.
Yeah.
Because just because you're in a carnivore diet, it should be ketogenic, but there's still ways around that. Like, it's not necessarily a ketogenic diet.
No, it's not. And I think in my case, I've experienced that where I've had protein so elevated and fat so reduced that I no longer was in ketosis. Well, I don't know. I think I was. Like we said, it's a sliding scale. Like, I was in slight ketosis, but I wasn't in ketosis enough to support my appetite. Because like you talked about, there is a thing. It's a great side effect of being in ketosis is your appetite goes to shit. You can go days without eating, right? So I think while there, I was having so much protein that my body was running through all this protein, metabolizing it into those like Krebs cycle intermediates, using those for fuel, and my body was not producing a lot of ketones. So I was not experiencing that appetite suppression that's like very classic of the keto diet. And that sucks. Being hungry all the time sucks, you know? But of course, there was a goal in mind, and you know, everything did work out as planned. But there are situations where your body can be burning so much extra protein that it just will not produce ketones, and then technically then you wouldn't be in ketosis. Yeah.
And I think that's just the ratio is like what the difference is. It's not how much protein you're getting, it's how much protein are you getting in comparison to fat.
With the fat, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but we're still trying to figure that out. I don't know if that's 70-30, 80-20, 60-40.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's going to vary from person to person, obviously.
It is, yeah. There's a guy doing research for his podcast called The Diabetic Warrior, and he has a website. I'm pretty sure that's what the website is, diabeticwarrior.com. And he was similar to Jimmy Moore, obese, heavy set, reversed his type 2 diabetes with a low carb diet. You know, this whole carnivore, I think he did this maybe 2 years ago. It's kind of an older post of his, but he tried the carnivore diet and his protein. A lot of people notice this, we did too. When you go carnivore, your protein just goes up. You're just naturally eating more protein, right? And so he had days where his protein was as high as 260 grams a day. And like for me, that ain't shit. But for most people, that's a lot of protein. And he said his calorie breakdown was close to 50-50, fat to protein, and his blood sugar averaged 84. And I think he did this, he was either for 3 months or 6 months. And
84 is perfect, especially for a type 2 diabetic or a former type 2.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's so really good.
Somebody like this guy just shows that, you know, the ratio does matter, that even in someone who is previously compromised, that all that extra protein was not being turned into sugar. Like, he was burning it for fuel. I know he was working out a lot, and it's just not true that our body's using all this protein for sugar. It's not.
I think, like, the time that your body might struggle is if you're going from a glucose-dependent diet, and then you're trying to switch to a ketogenic diet for the very first time. I could see your body being really confused, because it just doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, that's true. Like, we talked about this, going carnivore, for the most part, it should be pretty fucking simple. But if you're going from the standard American diet to carnivore, that's chicken breast and beef jerky every day.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
Good luck. Yeah. But we both know that people go to the grocery store and they associate chicken breast with health.
Yeah.
So that can definitely cause some issues. And there is a term called rabbit starvation, which is just when you eat a shit ton of lean protein and you don't get enough fat. And looking into this podcast did pique our interest into that more. So I think in the next week or maybe next 2 weeks, we're going to look into rabbit starvation and particularly what is going on with that. But I guess that's another topic for another day. But
literally.
That is literally going to happen. Yeah. But I wanted to talk about more situations where people probably should limit their protein, because I read a lot of studies on just people being fed a shit ton of protein and how their body responded to that protein for research for his podcast. And I'm going to put all this stuff on the website. I'm going to cite everything. And it was just so it was just so different. Well, for healthy people, it was not different. People who ate a lot of protein who were healthy, their blood sugar did not raise, their insulin went up, their glucagon went up. It was all hunky-dory.
Yeah.
It was fine. So if you're healthy out there, do not worry about protein. Go to town, make those gains. I don't give a shit. Eat 10 pounds of meat a day. You're going to be fine as far as that protein way. But people who are diabetic, and especially people who are insulin dependent, because there are, like, kind of like we said, there's gradients to being diabetic. There's people who just take metformin or other sort of pills to kind of help with their diabetes. And there's other people who have been diabetic for 10 years and now they're on, I don't know how many units of insulin every day. Those people are extremely compromised. And when people like that ate high protein meals, some people, sugars were okay for the most part, maybe went up 20, 30, 40. Other people would go up just like they ate, like a sandwich.
Like a cookie.
Like a cookie.
Yeah.
And it varied so much. It varied person to person that I really can't make a blank suggestion. But I just said that and I'm going to make a blank suggestion right now. But the blank suggestion would be just to try it for yourself. If you're out there and you do have type 2 diabetes, and especially if you're insulin dependent, this is going to suck because it's going to take a lot of blood like draws, but eat a meal, whatever meal that you like. If you like steak, if you like lamb or pork, and see what portion you eat and your blood sugar response to that, and kind of gauge your meals from that. If you can get down with eating, 16 ounces in one sitting and your blood sugar really doesn't respond, then okay, you're lucky. Go ahead. You know that protein is going to be good. But if you eat this protein and your blood sugar jumps up crazy, then maybe you need to pare it back, increase the fats, and find your ratio. Is your ratio 50-50 protein to fat? Is it 80-20 fat to protein? Like, what is it for you? And then go from there. And hopefully over time, you get more metabolically healthy and your body can support that protein metabolism more. And actually looking into this, diabetics are like almost constantly in a catabolic state.
Because of insulin?
Well, because of the insulin resistance for the glucagon.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so the thing with this, it kind of, which makes it more complicated when I tell people like right now to kind of dial back your protein and find your ratio, is that dialing back protein is kind of a shitty recommendation for someone who's constantly breaking down protein. Because that's how you waste away, So it's very case sensitive, and I would just recommend just finding out for yourself.
Well, I would think starting with protein low would be a good thing, because with that, if your protein's low and your sugar's low as well, your growth hormone should be higher because insulin's going to be lower.
And hopefully supporting your muscles.
Yeah, so like you should be breaking down less muscles if your growth hormone is higher, and then going up from there.
Yeah.
I would think that would be good.
So start low, then go high.
Yeah, I think that would be easier, and if you don't have enough protein, you'll kind of feel it.
Yeah,
have very low energy and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but then also if you have too much protein, you also have low energy because you're hypoglycemic. So it's a
weird thing. It's a yin and yang. Yeah, and we see it all the time. Like, well, I guess I do at least. Diabetics that have big bellies and tiny little arms, like their muscles are wasting away, but they're still so metabolically compromised that they're putting on fat. It's like it's the worst situation ever, where you're gonna be weaker and fatter.
Yeah, your insulin levels are just too high for your body to want to tap into your body fat.
But that glucagon will tap into your muscles. And specifically, alanine is the big amino acid that kind of constantly is elevated from diabetics. It's constantly being taken from diabetics, from their muscles, and shifted to their livers. So it's, diabetes is a shitty disease, man. Doing this whole research made me feel bad for diabetics. Even though this podcast wasn't initially supposed to be about diabetics, it was just supposed to be about, protein being turned into sugar, diabetics are so, I guess, so prevalent these days. All the research was about diabetics that I looked into. So
I feel like it's more common for you to have some form of insulin resistance than for you not to.
Yeah.
You're either diabetic or you're pre-diabetic or you're healthy. And I feel like the pre-diabetics and the diabetics probably outnumber the healthy.
They're a bigger pool.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah.
So there is another population that definitely should be limiting their protein. That would be cancer patients. Because cancer can fuel off of glucose. So the gluconeogenesis effect right there. Or not the gluconeogenesis. The
glycogenolysis.
Glycogenolysis, thank you.
Yeah.
That, and then also protein or cancer can be fueled by glutamine, which is the most abundant amino acid in protein. So if you're a cancer patient, I would highly recommend limiting your protein as well.
Yeah. And also, someone who is suffering from seizures, like epileptic episodes, it's been shown that a strict ketogenic diet and a strict, what would, is it 15% or 10% protein ketogenic diet? Strict, like real strict.
It's somewhere in that range.
It's in that range. So it's low as shit. It's pretty much you're finding just enough protein to stay in like nitrogen balance, but you're not going to be putting on a ton of muscle for sure. But I don't think people who are suffering from seizures give a shit if they're going to like be a bodybuilder. You know what I mean? So.
And then that's also going to depend on like how many seizures are you having? Are you one of those people that has seizures like once a month, or are you one of those people that has 15 seizures a day?
A day. Yeah. Yeah. You're just paralyzed. Yeah.
Because that's where most of the old research with the ketogenic diet is almost all of it's around epilepsy.
So if you're trying to stay in deep ketosis all the time, which someone who's like epileptic would, then I would recommend limiting your protein a little bit.
Yeah. But all those cases we just discussed are for very compromised individuals and not for the healthy individual.
Yeah, definitely not for the healthy individual. Yeah.
Seems like healthy individuals are somewhere between like that 20 to 30% protein range is most of the stuff I come across.
Yeah, that is definitely most of the stuff. And
I feel best around that range as well.
Yeah, I noticed when I get around that 50-50 range, my appetite becomes like ravenous. You know what I mean? Like it really becomes stupid hungry. So I think that is just not having enough fat to burn everything and fuel my workouts, and my body's just looking for food. And I think ideally I would probably top out around 40%. I would assume that'd probably be my high end, but 50-50 is a little much. You know what I mean?
It's also a little harder to do.
You have to try to do it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't naturally fall in a 50-50 range, I don't think. So.
For one of the classes I took in college, we had to come up with like our own diet and try to stick to it for a month. And one of the diets, the diet that I did was like a high protein diet. And it was like 45% of our calories coming from protein. And it was so hard to do because it's like.
And you weren't fat adapted at the time.
No. Yeah. The other 50% wasn't all fat. It was like 25% carbs, 25% fat. 50% protein. So I was trying to eat a lot of stuff that's like, okay, I can't have too many eggs because there's too much fat in that. I can't have bacon because there's too much fat in that. So it's a lot of like lean meat sandwiches, which just like wasn't good.
No.
Just kind of like, you have to really try to do that. So like 50-50 is like not only not the smartest type, but like it's hard to do.
Yeah, it is. That is hard to do. Yeah. Like someone like me, I planned a whole meal plan around it, all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, 50-50 seems more of a, like a cut. Isn't that like what you're aiming for with your cut?
Yeah, exactly. 50-50? Yeah. It was pretty much forcing my body to use body fat for fuel. But that's not like... like cavemen back in the day didn't give a fuck if they had abs.
No.
Like it's not like our body wants to really give up extra body fat when you're not that fat. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not like I'm 500 pounds. My body's like, yo, get this off me. I'm like 220 trying to get to like 205. So it's just, yeah. But yeah, I guess just to... wrap it up a little bit, like the body just won't create glucose just cuz. If there is a need for glucose somewhere in the body, it will create it. Like if the liver needs to be replenished with glycogen, it will create it. However, if there is no need for extra glucose, the body has other ways to deal with this excess protein, and it won't just turn it into glucose. There's more it can do.
Yeah, our bodies just aren't trying to have hyperglycemia causing hyperinsulinemia for no damn reason.
Nope.
That's what would happen if gluconeogenesis was just occurring rampantly.
Yeah, exactly.
Out of control.
And I guess, yeah, I want to touch a little bit on people are worried about overeating protein. And if you're eating like a steak, which I don't know, where maybe around 70-30 fat to protein, it's actually really hard to overeat protein because protein is so satiating. So as far as a hormonal response to protein, so protein suppresses hunger by suppressing ghrelin, which is a hunger hormone, but also it elevates a hormone called peptide YY, which is something called a full hormone. So that hormone makes you feel full. So protein in that way is kind of like a double whammy on a hormone way to suppress appetite. So yeah, it's just hard to overeat protein from a hormonal standpoint. Like even someone like me, I'm not the best example for this, but how much protein can you eat in a day? Like how many pounds of meat? Like not that much, right?
4 or 5? 2 to 3 was...
my scale's so wrong. I mean, I
can probably do close to 4, but...
But if you're just eating when you're hungry...
See, I don't care. I don't measure any of this stuff anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I try not to worry about any of this stuff. So maybe it is closer to 4.
Okay.
Probably 3 seems like a good number because I think I do more than a pound, like at each meal.
In a sitting. Okay.
Yeah. Like, I don't know how much an egg weighs. So I don't know like how much is four pieces of bacon and like six eggs?
I
don't know.
Yeah. I don't know either. Yeah. But it shows that's the thing with protein. It is very satiating. So it is hard to overeat protein. So if you just eat till you're full, which is something we tell our clients all the time, eat till you're full, then go ahead, you'll be fine. And I don't care if that's like a pound of meat or if that's 2 pounds of meat, then just go ahead and eat it, you're okay. If that's a dozen eggs, go ahead and eat it, you'll be okay. Like your body, it's smart, man. It'll tell you what to do. But if you are full, stop eating. Like listen to your body. Don't force feed yourself. There's no need for it.
And one thing we probably should touch on at the beginning of the podcast is we're talking about protein from natural sources. We're not talking about some like protein shake, muscle milks or anything like that. Because you can consume, I don't know, 2,000 grams of protein if you're just drinking nothing but muscle milks all day long.
Yeah, that's true. And that's a good point. All this stuff revolves around, like I've said a million times the past few podcasts, like the speed of digestion. It does really matter. And it gives our body a chance to really assess what the body needs at that particular time and then fill those voids. Something like carbohydrates don't. Carbohydrates don't give our body options. It gives it one option, which is a shit ton of sugar right now, and it says, yo, fix this problem. And then our body has to deal with it. And I don't know exactly the digestion of, say, like a whey protein shake, but I know it's like a bolus of amino acids. It's all these fucking amino acids in a liquid form ready to go right now. So the hormonal response, I'm assuming is different. How different? I'm not 100% sure. But we do promote just eating whole foods. You should get your protein from, I don't care, a steak, a chicken, whatever. That's where you should get your protein from.
There's so much more that Mother Nature has with that steak.
It's not just protein.
Yeah, there's enzymes to help you digest it. There's fat. There's so many other benefits that come with it. If you're just doing a protein shake, like you're just getting protein, the amino acids, I don't even know if the ratios are right of the amino acids in those protein shakes.
And actually learning more about this podcast and that certain amino acids are insulinogenic, so they promote insulin, and other amino acids are glucogenic, meaning they promote glucagon. Actually, it's not glucogenic. It's
glycogen.
Fuck, I forget that word. Something like that.
Glycogenetic?
Whatever. Certain amino acids promote a glucagon response. So it does matter how much protein, but also the particular amino acids in that meal. So something from an animal-based product, you're going to be getting the right amount of protein with the right amino acid profile to support the proper hormonal response. And there was actually this quote that I pulled again from one of these websites. I'll post it on the site that just talked about people thinking you eat a steak and then a half hour later, all of it's just getting turned into sugar. Like anything over 30 grams, your body's not going to use, going to turn into sugar. Your mileage may vary, but if your digestion is so quick that within 30 minutes, a 12 ounce steak has been entirely dispatched by your stomach acid, moved onto your small intestine, and the individual amino acids have been absorbed into the portal circulation to be delivered to your liver, and the liver has converted them into glucose, and they've been sent out into the bloodstream, all within 30 minutes, then you, my friend, should be charged. You should charge scientists to study you because you are quite the physiological oddity. That just shows all the shit that happens when we digest food. That's just not happening in 30 minutes. A half hour after we eat a steak, you know where that stomach is? I mean, where that steak still is? It's in our stomach, you know? So
that's kind of funny. Like, the language is kind of too nice there. I was like, no, you, that is you're fucking, that, yeah, that's insane. That can't happen.
It's not happening. Yeah, it's not. But that is happening when you drink like a Coke. All that sugar is rushed through you so quick, it'll blow your mind. So I think that's good for gluconeogenesis. Again, don't worry about it. It is hormonally driven. It's not substrate driven. So all my gym bros out there, you're trying to eat protein, go ahead, get your gains in. Don't worry about it. Eat all the steak you want. You'll be all right. If you are type 2 diabetic, you suffer from seizures, or you're just metabolically compromised, then maybe start low, work your way up, and find what ratio works for you. But either way, you want to get your glucose coming from protein or fat. You don't want your glucose coming from an outside source like sugars or like Pepsi's, potato, shit like that. Let our body create the sugar it needs when it needs to. Don't force its hand by, you know, juggling a Coke every morning, you know?
Yeah, so are we on to the tip of the week?
We are.
All right, so I don't think you agree completely with this tip of the week.
Okay.
So if you have any pushback, feel free to give it to me.
Sure.
This one is throw away your scale. Most people use their weight to figure out they're healthy or not. And I honestly think that's a horrible way to judge your health. The first thing you do when you go to the doctor's office, before you even go see the doctor, you step on the scale And then they're just kind of judging you right from the beginning. How much do you weigh? Okay. So I used to wrestle when I was in high school. I was cutting weight. So I was obsessed with the scale. I would be stepping on the scale multiple times a day, multiple times an hour if I had access to it. When I was cutting weight, so my weight was very fluctuating like a bit at that moment because my water weight was pretty limited. I was still changing weights about 10 pounds in a given day. So, you know, if I stepped on the scale first thing in the morning, maybe I was 150. At the end of the day, I was probably like 140. So that's 10 pounds just depend on one day. So why would you use that type of measurement that changes so much to base your health off of? And then with a low carb, high fat diet, one thing that's going to happen is your insulin levels are going to be low and your growth hormone is going to be high. So that's perfect for creating muscle growth and perfect also for burning fat. So that could be a net neutral on a scale. So you lost fat and you gained muscle, which is what most people's ideal goals are. So that scale might not be moving, even though you're getting the results that you want. But you're looking at the scale and now you're getting discouraged because it's not moving, even though your jeans are fitting better, your shirts are fitting better, you need a belt, or you're fitting in some jeans you haven't fit in like a decade. You know, all these other things are moving, but the scale still isn't changed. So like for all those reasons, I just think it's a horrible thing. And then also like people become obsessed with that scale number. So I think it's more likely to sabotage your success, causing you to stress out because you're not seeing that scale move, than it is to actually help you. Because what are you going to do with that number anyway? Unless you are a wrestler.
Tweet about it.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like, who cares? Like, unless you are a wrestler or, you know, a rower and some sort of fighter, like that scale number means absolutely nothing to you. So I just don't understand like why so many people are obsessed with it. Hey, I lost 20 pounds this month. Cool. Is that all fat or is it just water? Or did you just weigh yourself at the right time of day, both days, to get that like the biggest variance
possible? Biggest gap possible.
Yeah. So for all those reasons, I think you should just throw away your scale, or you know what? Just give it to somebody you don't even like. So let it sabotage their life instead of yours.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Friends like that, who needs enemies? Fuck. But no, I don't. I don't disagree with you. I personally haven't weighed myself in a very long time. I mean, legit over maybe 6 months, 8 months, I have not weighed myself. I kind of guesstimate. And like I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, I take either pictures or videos of myself training and I gauge my progress, how I look. And I think that's a better way to gauge things if you care about how you look.
Yeah.
And
because like, why would you care if you lost 20 pounds or if you didn't? If you look better, you have more definition,
that's
you
what
look
matters.
Bigger. Like, that's what matters.
Yeah.
The most important measurement for me is how much energy I have. Because if I have a lot of energy, then I'm probably doing the right thing.
Doing something right.
If I have low energy, like or I do right now, then, you know, it's because I'm sick or because of something else. I'm not doing something right. So I think those are just way better measurements than some damn scale.
Yeah. No, I do agree with that. The only thing, and I think I know what you're talking about, I always tell people to weigh out like once a week or once every 2 weeks. And people do talk to me as far as like clients go, wanting to lose weight and all this type of shit. And then I get it. But someone like me, I don't care how much I weigh. Someone like you, you don't care how much you weigh. But I've never been 100 pounds overweight and obese, yeah. Right? And I've never stepped on a scale and looked at a number and been terrified. And I know for a lot of people out there, that is a reality. I know a lot of people step on a scale and cry because they weigh 300 pounds and in high school they weighed 95. And they don't know what's going on. They don't know why. And that number is more their identity than their actual name. They feel like they are 300 pounds. That's who they are. And so for those people, when they say they lost 20 pounds, that's just an easy way to represent the work they put in. Even though for us, we don't give a shit. We think they should just focus on being healthy. But for people like that who have been overweight, who have suffered with the honestly stigma of being obese, because I know that's not an easy life. You know what I mean? People, you can't hide being obese.
Yeah.
You can hide being dumb. Just don't open your fucking mouth. You know what I mean? But you can't hide being obese. So for those people, that number does matter. And I understand why they weigh themselves. And I try and limit most people to just once a week, say, see what's going on. And it's a way to kind of get a dialogue started. But it never fails. Every time I talk to people outside, they're always like, oh, I weighed myself today. I weighed myself this day. And I'm like, please don't. Weigh yourself at most once a week. And if you can do it maybe once a month, that'd be better. But it's a tricky situation. It's almost a more of a psychological problem more than just a representation of a number. You know what I mean? It's like the image. So it's just, I think it's a little more complex.
Well, I just think you can, instead of, hey, you know, I lost 80 pounds. Hey, I lost 6 dress sizes. Like, that's still a really good progressive mark.
Yeah.
And like, that's, you know, like, it's a lot of people like, hey, I know I didn't lose any weight this week. And they kind of stress out over it. And it's just like, well, did you lose a pant size? Or do you have more energy?
Do you feel stronger?
Yeah, like there's other things. Like you could lose a pant size and not lose any pounds.
Yeah.
You can step on the scale the wrong way and you'll get a different reading. You can lean back and forth and that scale will change even though you're still standing on it. Mm-hmm. You still weigh the same.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. There's just, I just think it's such a horrible measuring tool and it seems like it's most people's most important measuring tool.
Yes, I agree. That it definitely shouldn't be. Yeah.
Yeah. If I mean, if you're going to use it, it should be like the 10th most important thing instead of the most important. And I just see so many people just become obsessed with that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It just kind of drives me crazy. And it's just like, man, that scale's like, it's not that accurate.
And it's not your friend.
Yeah.
It's not.
Just go weigh yourself before you go to sleep. And then when you wake up, you're going to drift about 4 to 5 pounds.
And that's just from breathing.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, it's not that, you know, it's not the best measuring tool.
No,
so,
it's not.
I don't know. Just people become a little bit too obsessed with it. If you are one of those people and you don't want to throw away your scale because you spent $500 on it and it checks your body fat percentage and all these other things, feel free to just, I wouldn't either rely on that number that much or just, I wouldn't even step on it except maybe every, like, 3 months, every 6 months. I mean, it is good at checking like general trends, but it's not that good to really rely upon.
Yeah, and base your happiness on it. Definitely don't do that. Yeah. All right, that's another episode in the books. Thank you for listening. You can find us at TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. We're on all social media, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You'll find us TNT Wellness.
Yeah, thank you. Please rate and subscribe. We're on Apple iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud. Tell your friends about us. Hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.